I would have raised this up anyhow. At my age, you hate to see something shaped like this drooping. I'm Don Gates, an alcoholic. I commended Peggy on her talk there. I have probably delivered, I don't know how many, probably 100,000 or more AA talks over the years, and no one has ever criticized me for quitting early. That was a fine talk. It's good to see you young people coming in and not having to go through the hell I did, I'll tell you. There is true. You know, I have seen people give a talk and they get into a place where they've really got a great punch, time to get off, and they'll look at their watch and say, oh, still have 10 minutes. Well, in 1934, I switched from pork to Muscatel. They lose the whole point of it. You know, as I have oft mentioned, I was a main speaker at my second AA meeting. Never confuse glibness with sincerity or intelligence. The first meeting that I recall attending was the Beverly Hills Men's Stag meeting. I didn't mean to go there. I was trying to get back into my profession, and I had called a law firm, and the guy said, I'll be glad to talk to you, but suppose we get together an interview at 8:30 in the Roxbury Park. And I thought, that's a rather strange place for a business function, 8:30 at night in a park. But I'd heard about Hollywood. And so I showed up, and it was the men's stag there in Roxbury Park. It was on a Wednesday. And naturally, I had been drunk the whole weekend, but I'd tapered off quite a bit on Monday. And in fact, I think I had some chili on Tuesday. So I wasn't in bad shape. I mean, I wasn't sitting on my hands. I was very quick, but I listened to the speakers, and I was truly impressed. They were men of some stature, intelligence, active in their community. I recognized some of them. Some of you here are old enough, I'm sure, to remember Jack Bailey, the Queen for a Day fella. He was there, and I was delightful. Later, I was becoming good friends with him. But all of these people spoke, and I was just really impressed. And I'm sort of chameleon-like. I can take on the coloring, the hue of any environment in which you place me. I go to jail, and I realize that being a regular is the thing here. Butt off, screw. Afraid somebody's going to put the arm on me, but in AA, I could see that humility was the gig. And I could out-humble any clown in the house when I put my mind to it. And so at the end of the meeting, the speaker looked around and said, well, let's see, 5-minute pitch meeting here, and we still have 5 minutes left. Who will we get to close it? How about the young fellow in the front row with the shiny black hair? That was your humble servant 53 years ago. And so I got up, because as I say, I've been AA now for better than 45 minutes. And so I gave him a couple of moments of pathos, a couple of moments of humor, ended on a rising note of hope, and sat down. And they swarmed about me to touch the hem of my garment. And one fellow said, you haven't spoken out the Royal Seiko recently, have you? Well, I had just drunk my way down from San Francisco with a brief stop for undergraduate work in Camarillo Mental Hospital. So I had no idea what the Royal Seiko was, so I was reasonably certain I hadn't spoken there. And he said, I'm leading the meeting, and next, whatever it was, the next week there, would you come and be my main speaker? I said, certainly, always glad to help the poor devil crushed by the juggernaut demon rum. So that gave me time for more pathos, more humor, and an even more soaring note of hope. And if you can make two people chuckle at in a meeting, you'll get two invitations for the price of one. So within a month, I was booked up. I stayed sober on the novelty of applause and a solid bowel movement. Yeah. Sure, you people who are made of sterner stuff can giggle about that, but if you've ever experienced it, you don't know the sense of worth, the rise in self-esteem. Yea, verily, that sense of manly virility, the first time you're able to break wind without fear of following through. That alone should get you one birthday cake. So I was bigger out in the San Gabriel Valley than Chuck Chamberlain. And the only thing is that after a couple of years, the novelty of grunting in the morning wears off. And I got taken drunk, which didn't surprise anybody but me. And I had a hell of a time with it. I used to count my birthdays. One, two, one, two, one, two. I couldn't seem to get through that third year. And people would say, well, Don, you've got to get into your inventory. And so I would take plume and paper and go up my stream of consciousness looking for character defects, and I still have trouble. And they'd say, well, you've got to work with a newcomer. And so I would drag him in off the bar stools, alcoholic or not, ready or not, and I still have trouble. And I said, you must find God. And so I would pursue him up and down the byways of the San Fernando Valley, and I'd still have trouble. And then coming up on 44 years ago, I decided to quit drinking. And I haven't had any trouble since. One thing. That was what I liked about your talk. I mean, it was the basic thing. The one thing old timers have in common is they don't drink. I was down in Texas one time speaking at a convention of some kind, and they had a sign up on the wall that said, if you want to quit drinking, you're going to have to quit drinking. And I thought, that is the most moronic statement I have seen, even in Texas, where idiocy is a goal. But the more I reflected on it, the more I realized they had captured, as they often do in the Southwest there, they had captured the heart of our program. If you want to quit drinking, you're just going to have to quit drinking. I mean, that's all there is to it. And there's nothing magical about it. When I first came around, I thought alcoholism was a strange and mysterious malady for which science not only had no cure, they didn't even have an accurate definition. And now it seems to me, without question, the simplest disorder ever to have afflicted mankind, the most easily recognizable, identifiable, and treatable. The very name, alcoholism, gives you such a marked clue as to what the problem is. That if you weren't handicapped with a degree in psychology and someone were to say to you, what do you think causes alcoholism? I warrant you'd come up with a correct response instantly. Alcohol? You know, no alcohol, no alcoholics. Simple as that. There's nothing, no character graph that you can take of our emotions, our psyches, that distinguishes us from the non-alcoholic. I've never known an alcoholic to suffer from a problem that non-alcoholics don't suffer from. You know, and the only thing is they don't have to do anything about it. They can go through life miserable, discontented, angry, hostile, clinging to those dubious luxuries of resentment and self-pity, getting even, paying back. You watch them outside the divorce courts. They don't want justice, they want blood. Gonna get that bitch on the stand, make her admit she's an unfit mother right in front of the children. Yeah. And they never have to change. They can live lives of quiet desperation. We unfortunates can't. We have to live happily. I mean, I know newcomers, so I can say that without scaring anybody off. But happiness, even contentment, can be endured. we don't want it, obviously. I mean, when we're new, we wouldn't cross the street if we thought it'd make us feel better. Stand right here and take it, and take it as long as you can, goddamn. Yeah. But we have to give up those traits that make for unhappiness, because if we don't, we get taken drunk. Non-alcoholic, they don't have any goad like that. No one's ever been arrested for driving while pissed off. We have to, and it isn't that bad. I don't speak anymore without exception. I very rarely take a talk. Lee somehow blackmailed me into this one. But I have lost all of my favorite stories and rhymes and things like that. Tanya, always being a helpful mate, suggested I bring a tape and play it down here while mouth syncing it. But she's always being helpful to everyone, and you may have noticed she has a 40-year medallion now. I've been sober 40 years and came in as a fetus, and one of the main reasons I don't go back to drinking is that I want that seniority. If we have a disagreement, I can say to her, "That's okay, honey. I used to think like that when I had only 40 years." But it has been a good life and a good wife to go along with it. I don't know. Someone told me I should. You know, when you speak, you can put together pearls of insight that would make a startlingly intellectual necklace. But the only thing the audience is going to remember is some story that you tell where you made an absolute horse's ass of yourself. That they remember. So I kind of got caught up with a story that people, even here, somebody asked me about it. It goes back to an incident that occurred many years ago, and it was the first time I had insight into the degree of my drinking problem. I didn't even think of it as a problem, because no matter what happened to me, I could always blame someone else for contributing to it. It's almost impossible to come into conflict with society unless some other member of society is there engaging. And on this particular occasion that I'm going to describe, by the way, I should preface it by saying that I only drank to relax, primarily at least. And on this occasion, I'd been relaxed about a week. And I awoke from a tormented sleep. There had been visions of Dante's Inferno, imps of the perverse. I could smell the sulfur as I staggered up to my feet and drenched with perspiration. And I thought, what's wrong? I mean, can it possibly have something to do with liquor? But then I realized such wasn't the case, because I saw that I had nodded off on the couch, my family having gone to wherever it was they used to go at night. And from this couch, there now was a spire of smoke emanating from a little hole. And I realized that what had happened was I'd nodded off with a cigarette in my hand or mouth. It had fallen on the covering of this couch and burned its way inside, where, lacking oxygen to take flame, the embers had simply spread over the course of the night. And I saw that nothing wrong with my drinking, I'd just been barbecued. Yeah. So, commending myself and my perspicacity, I went into the kitchen, came back with a pitcher of water, and tried to pour it into that tiny hole. I produced a rather spectacular cascade on the carpet, but beyond that, nothing. And so I knew more drastic measures were required. So I returned to the kitchen, came back with a butcher knife, sliced the couch open from one end to the other, and then subdued the embers with the cooling balm of the water. Now that's been 50 or more than 50 years ago, half a century, a quarter of this nation's history. And I can still remember standing there, my eyes watering from the acrid black smoke that it produced, and realizing that slashed and sodden mass, my wife was almost surely going to notice it. She was a keen-eyed woman. There was a little that passed her ken around the house, I'll tell you. And though she was not an Al-Anon, nonetheless, she would never want to say anything disrespectful to her the head of the household. But on the other hand, in moments of tension, she would say things to me that were unkind, cruel even. I mean, she might say, "You drunken son of a bitch, you did it again, didn't you?" And then she would feel terrible remorse for having spoken thus. And I wanted to spare her this. And come on in, I'm just reaching the height of the story here. And I wanted to spare her this. The only thing was I didn't know what to do. But for every problem, no matter how complex, there's one simple solution, which is wrong. But it occurred to me, it's simple. Just get the couch out of the house. I mean, she might vaguely remember there'd been something on that side of the room, but out of sight, out of mind. The only thing is, it isn't easy to be moving a couch when you should be checking into a sanitarium. With that Herculean strength that comes only to the youthful, panic-stricken alcoholic, I managed to heft that monster onto my back and stagger out the front door. At that time, we were living on the second floor of an apartment building that had a little porch-type balcony with columns, and I remember virtually beating myself to death trying to make the turn, you know, bung, bung. But eventually, I did descend, and then I realized that, like Bobby Burns' mouse, foresight had not been my long suit. There is virtually no place to conceal a couch in a typical apartment patio. So I'm standing there, legs trembling. I should be in a hospital, but I'm moving furniture. And I remembered a creek about 5 miles away. And so I lurched to my car and hefted that brute up on top of it and got in to drive to my selected place of repose. And the only thing I ever wanted in life, the only thing to which I truly sought, was dignity. I could face disaster if I could face it with dignity. But as I was driving down the street, by this time it was, I don't know what time it was daylight anyhow, and there were people at the bus stops, you know, with lunch pails and briefcases. I don't know how they stay up that late, but, you know, they're out there. And I was driving down the street, and I noticed that their heads all turned and followed my progress. I thought, by golly, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California, I'll say that. You know. Until I passed an auto dealership that had a dusty window that acted like a giant mirror. And I saw what it was they were looking at. Here's a guy, Natalie, clad in a bathrobe, a week's growth of beard, and on top of his car rests a couch, which previously had lacked oxygen to take flame. But going down the street, the wind was going through it like a billows. Ooh! You know, flames were 30, 40 feet in the air. And then when I ultimately returned I actually found it impossible to blame my sleeping wife and children for the imperilment of their lives they had brought about. I began to realize that liquor was playing a not insignificant role in my life. But that's enough. Let's just say that subsequently I was to move beyond social drinking. In the later stages of my drinking, I wasn't getting into any trouble at all. I mean, how much trouble can you get into in a hotel room with a bottle of wine and a copy of Playboy? If the maid doesn't step on you, you're reasonably safe, but you're in there dying. And you know about AA. I read the book before I was old enough to even buy a drink legally. And you know, we have a kind of an odd sell on our program. We talk in the promises. They read at the end of the meeting frequently about how in time, if we join this program, we will trudge the road of happy destiny. And I thought, trudge, of all the words in the English language used to denote locomotion, they picked out trudge. I mean, I didn't ask for skip, come, aloo, traipsy, but certainly you could walk with dignity. Trudge, that's what's being offered. I mean, that Rudyard Kipling, boots, marching up and down again, there's no discharge in the war. I mean, that isn't exactly enticing. And yet, that's what they offered us. And it didn't seem, it looked, when you first come around, it looks like you're going to be spending an endless number of Friday nights walking through a dark cave with no light, no fun, staggering up an arid mount carrying your cross of sobriety. It isn't a pretty picture. And yet, oddly enough, it turns out that is exactly the opposite of that. For the first time, you're freed to do whatever you want. You can do it and remember it and know whether you want to repeat it. And I believe, you know, I didn't do anything when I was drinking. Thought I did, I guess. But you don't do anything just sitting in a bar stool looking into that mirror at that handsome fella, getting more glassy-eyed all the time. And I didn't do anything. And since I've been sober, to the best of my knowledge, I have done everything that I ever fantasized about doing. Much of it I wouldn't repeat. You can do it in that position, but it'll throw your back out. You know. And I've had people say, well, Don, why is your program more enthusiastic, more ebullient than mine? And I tell them, I don't think it is. I think I just do things. You know, I said, have you learned to fly since you got sober? No. Well, I did. I took training out at the old Whiteman Airport in San Fernando Valley, took 3 hours and learned to land, take off and land. Rented it that weekend, flew to San Francisco. I didn't know anything about navigation. It didn't have any instruments. I just flew over Highway 101. Ha ha, work the steps. Took up parachute jumping just before I became a grandfather. Rode motorcycles, the only copy of the big book they used to see out around Barstow on Sunday. You know, I couldn't have done those things when I was drinking. It would look dignified. People might have thought there was something wrong with my life, do things like that. Took up scuba diving. I know you're supposed to practice, you know, put on things and get into a pool and find out what's happening. I'm one of those, I don't have time for that. You know, I'm a fast study. Hum a couple of bars, I'll pick it up. So I put in all of the gear and off of Catalina Island, jumped in, got so delighted down in Seaweed City that I stayed down so long I ran out of air. I put my higher power to the test, I'll tell you. That's a nice thing about our program. No matter what you do, you've got a scapegoat. You know, in decades now, I have not made a single mistake. not one deviation from the path of valor and rectitude have I been guilty of, no faux pas even. On the other hand, God has seen fit to do through me some of the dumbest, most egomaniacal, lewd, lurid, aggressive things he could imagine. Yeah. But if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, who is he to criticize? I mean, take it up with a higher power. Don't talk to me. I've taken the third step. And so, life has been so extraordinarily good to me on this program. Things have happened to me that were on beyond belief. And by the way, I don't want to scare, if there is a newcomer who didn't raise his hand, I don't want to scare you off by thinking it's all going to be happy. It isn't. You're going to know moments of pain and anguish, things that'll curl your hair, and there won't be a damn thing you can do about it. You'll just stand there and hurt. You can't run away anymore. Don't give up hope. It'll be painful at times. After a fairly lengthy marriage, I suddenly found myself a bachelor. My wife had left, and I was raising the youngest of my children, about 13 or 14 then, and I thought, no good can come of this but break my heart in two. I'd like to tell you that as a result of our program, he and I were able to converse one-to-one. But any man who says that he converses with his teenage children will lie about other things. Yeah. Obviously, you can't talk to them. I mean, they have no command of the language sufficient to express any emotions, even if they had a background in which to look at them. I mean, he lived in the front of the house. I lived in the rear. The only time I used to see him, I'd just throw money in the hall and wait. It isn't that they're totally inarticulate. They put something into their record-playing machines, inarticulate grunts of some sort, and play it very loud. But beyond that, they're incomprehensible. But we survived, and after a reasonable period of time, a beautiful young lady came along who now has 40 years on the program, and already she had quite a bit at that time too, but we've been married now for 28 years, and she raised that child, and she seems to like me, which is very good. She never objected to old age creeping on her at night, and that was even better. And we have done all sorts of wonderful things, things that we never would have done otherwise. I mean, we have hiked in the Alps. We wanted to see if river rafting might be fun. So we thought we'd find some place where we could sign up for a little test run. But then we found out you could go down the whole length of the Grand Canyon if you wanted to sign up for 10 days. Well, moderation being a rumor to the alcoholic. Naturally, we went signed up for the whole thing. But then we got to Flagstaff, where they were organizing the boats, and we saw a lot of people were smoking, and we had to quit smoking. Didn't rush into it, waited till we got emphysema, but we had to quit smoking, and here were people smoking, and one guy saying about what you could take, he said, he's not taking any beer, can I take two cases? Good God, we're going to be down in the bottom of a huge cavern now for better than a week with smoking and drinking. We better cut our losses and get out of here. But we decided we'd stick around and just put up the money. We'd get off halfway down if we wanted, I guess. And it turned out that we were assigned to a raft that had 8 Jehovah's Witnesses from Texas and 2 Mormons. Nobody smoked, nobody drank. They're all there to have a great time. I mean, I'm not saying higher power picks me out. I mean, I know higher God loves everybody, but I'm his favorite, I sometimes think. Although you wouldn't know it sometimes from the way I behave. The Jehovah's Witnesses, they tried to proselytize the boat guys who ran the boat. And they didn't speak to me at all. Probably because on the very first day, I looked up at one of those rock formations and said, "Look at that yonder rock. It looks very much like a watchtower. I hope no idiot's going to give me a pamphlet." And it was a wonderful trip. We've done all kinds of wonderful things. And apart from marriage and social events, the most important thing in many men's life, certainly in mine, having been a depression person growing up during the Depression, I know that, you know, I tell newcomers that I'm with it, don't worry about getting a job. Nobody has starved in California since the early 30s. Many have died of drunkenness, but you're not going to starve no matter what happens. And I know that's true for them. I've seen it happen over and over again. But it isn't true for me. If I were out of work for 3 days, I would starve. I visualize it coming home in the afternoon, having marched around with my briefcase and my Hickey Freeman suit, and there beside my swimming pool are my children, black-eyed, bloated bellies, crying, "Bread, Daddy, bread, for the love of God, bread!" So I have had to work. And it was really hard in the beginning. Once I got squared away with the Bar Association and was able to get back into my profession, I had known by this time, had discovered at least, that our stories can be the source of innocent merriment. But I had not realized that the non-alcoholic public will fail to see the humor in them. And so I remember going into this one law firm and talking to one of the senior partners, and I thought I'd tell them a few icebreakers, not big boffo jokes, but just a few little fun stories about, like, say, the time I got drunk and threw my mother-in-law down the steps, and being intoxicated, fell after it, got a hernia. You know, some little story like that, not a big one. And this guy didn't giggle a gig, titter a tit. He just kind of stared at me. And I thought, I guess I'm being too subtle for him. So I told him about the time I was in four-point restraint and vomited straight up. And that got a reaction. You know. And so I finally said, "Well, look, I'm not asking you to recommend me." He said, "Recommend you? Recommend you? I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things you've done or had happen to him, the things that have happened for you. My advice is forget the law. Go into the countryside, try to regain your health in simple labor." Boy, I was not ready for that, I'll tell you. I had not anticipated that. When we send lawyers into the courtroom representing our clients, they represent strength in the face of adversity, determination, and grit. Send you? Never. Boy, I'll tell you, if I could have slithered like a serpent across the floor under the door to drown the shame of that in that bottomless bottle like I always did, I'd have done it. But if I thought if I do, then he'll be right. I can't take it. I won't give that fellow the satisfaction. I drank coffee at him. About 10 years later, that guy flipped out, took a check protector, one of the secretaries, ran off to Paris, disgraced his law firm, disgraced the legal profession, disgraced his family, the city of Pasadena. One of the most beautiful pyrotechnic displays of misconduct I ever saw, and he did it cold sober. On the other hand, about 30 years later, the governor of our state called me and told me he was appointing me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office held by a sober alcoholic, at least in the state of California. You know what happened for the next 15 years? When those lawyers they sent came into my courtroom, they stood up and they remained standing until I told them they could be seated. All power to the powerless. You know, and yet, I haven't really changed that much. I don't think we really do change that much. Our characters are pretty well established from infancy on, virtually. It's simply that our traits are changed, motivated to produce good ends instead of bad ones. Bill Wilson, all the other people who got sober in the Oxford movement, they were quite happy about it. Attended meetings, that was enough for them. Not Bill. Remember, he's a stockbroker, he's a boomer, he's a goer. He's gonna make $1 million, write a book. Make $1 million. And he did, he wrote the AA book. Without him, we'd all be out chewing our tongue in the gutter, probably, as a result of his character defects. My good friend Chuck Chamberlain, the most spiritual man I ever met, he didn't get spiritual because he joined AA. I knew friends of his who drank in Beverly Hills when he was still drinking, and they said we'd walk into a bar and say, buy the house a drink, and then we would spot Chuck. Not that preacher down on the end. I don't want to get him started. So Chuck didn't change all that much, but he became the most inspiring man I ever met. Clancy Imishlin, some of you may have heard of. I knew him when he came into L.A. with no teeth. He'd been kicked out in the jail in the drunk tank. Somebody overreacted. And and he was the greatest flim-flam man I ever met. And he still is. The only thing is, he uses his persuasive abilities now to save people that are almost insolubly insolvable. When I used to get a newcomer, not only couldn't I answer his questions, I didn't even know what the hell he was talking about. I'd take him out to Clancy's house about midnight, put him on the porch, ring the doorbell, and run. See, Clancy really hasn't changed all that much, nor did Chuck, nor did Bill, nor did I. Being in the appellate courts is the thing I'm best primed to do. I'm articulate, I write well, and ideas are more important to me than people. My world lies within me. And so I became a pretty good judge. I didn't get emotionally caught up in things. I wrote decisions in which AA found its way directly. You know, we have our own mantra, our own way of speaking. We don't realize it sometimes, but it's how we identify with each other. The patois of AA is you're in line in a store and when somebody starts to come in front of you, oh, no, no, go ahead, no, you go first, easy does it. Oh, you're a friend of Bill, yeah. And so we have a whole series of languages that we use. And I find that they creep into everything. I wrote decisions in which are a commentary. In law, we say, for example, that a complaint sounds in tort, or it sounds in equity, or it sounds in contract. I don't know why we say that. Probably Blackstone said it 300 years ago, and somebody said, that's a grabber. And so this one, what they're saying is that this guy's complaint is trying to state a cause of action, I mean, in a particular field. And this guy one time filed an improper, representing himself in a divorce matter. He filed an appeal that I said there was no point in analyzing appellate's appeal in detail. Suffice it to say that it sounds in self-pity and resentment, but it states no cause of action known to the law. I even once said, in law, as in life, half measures avail us nothing. and my colleagues say, where did you get those expressions? I don't know, they just pop out. They come to me. And sometimes they are odd, though. I remember one time during oral argument, an attorney, they're allowed to come in and argue once a month, half an hour of sound signifying nothing. And this one fellow was trying to urge us not to be too harsh on his client, even though he hadn't been entirely truthful when he'd been arrested for 5 murders. And I heard myself, or at least someone where I was seated, saying, do not worry, counsel, we all understand that murder very often leads to lying. Fortunately, I didn't follow it up by saying, and if he doesn't get honest, he'll soon be in real trouble, he'll be drinking. So life has been very good to me. There is no way that you can go from the handcuffs that I've been placed in to sitting on the California Supreme Court on occasion. That can't happen. If you were to put that in a soap opera, they'd drum you out of the business. It just is impossible. But in AA, miracles of that sort, not that dramatic perhaps, or not that typical, but everything that is going to happen will be an astonishment to you, and you'll find out you're ending up in a place where you should have been, but didn't ever hope to get or even think you wanted. I don't go to movies anymore because I was married to an actress for a while, but plenty of show business. But I understand that an actor, Gibson, is that his name? Got arrested for getting picked up, Mel Gibson, that is, got picked up for being drunk driving and gave an anti-Semitic tirade to the officer who arrested him. And recently I've been talking to the first, as far as I know, Hasidic rabbi who came under AA. And now that takes real courage. I mean, actors and actresses sometimes get treated inappropriately because they're known when they come to AA meetings. But an Hasidic rabbi, he's got the strange clothing, odd curls and so on. Got women aren't allowed to touch them. And so for him to come into AA takes us a lot of courage. It really does. And so I told him, I told him about Mel Gibson. I said, if he follows the path I have, from being arrested as an anti-Semite, drunk, within 30 years, he's going to become a rabbi. And I told this fellow, I said, you very possibly are Moses. You're coming in to lead the drunkards in your temple from the slavery of alcoholism. And I admire the guy very much. Naturally, the idea that women can't touch them, when a newcomer comes into AA, particularly if he's dressed like that, the ladies swarm. And he said, I think I can handle it. And he did. What he told them was that in my faith, we are taught that we touch people with our hearts and not our hands. I thought that was a good line. I'm going to use it. But the miracle that has happened to me will happen to you, I believe. It won't be the same thing, but it will happen. And I haven't changed that much. Still believe, act the way I used to in many ways. Trying never to hurt other people if I can avoid it. And doing it not because I think there's any reward in the hereafter or punishment in the hereafter, just I'd like to just live a life that doesn't hurt other people. I don't know, I've mentioned some of the crazy things I have done, and yet when I look back over my life, I think I regret not so much the things that I did, though I hate that I hurt people at times, but I regret the things I didn't do when I was capable of doing them. I am not accepting age gracefully. I used to be able to do many things that I can no longer do. I know you young people believe you're immortal, but in time, it isn't a matter that you know you're going to die someday. You realize you are dying. The pages on the calendars fall like the leaves in autumn. Time flies so fast. And yet, this is the only moments we have. If you want to do something to help society, strike a blow for justice, you have to do it right now. Nobody raises their hand for righteousness' sake in the tomb. If you want to do something loving, tender, gentle, lewd, lurid even, you have to do that now too. A poet said, "The grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace." Another poet said, "Into the fires of spring your winter garment of repentance fling. The bird of time has but a little way to flutter, and the bird is on the wing." My bird doesn't have very much longer to fly. I don't want to miss a beat. I hope all of you here will stick around and we'll fly together. Thank you.